I'll just do my best here. It's nice to be in Toronto. I'm really excited about this event happening again, especially after all the repression that has been in the last several months. I got here myself on Tuesday evening, and within an hour of being in the city, I was charged by riot police on horseback and then punched in the face by a cop at the anti-fascist demo that night. I'm eager to talk with you all about fighting police, and I'm sure that at least one of you is a police officer. And I want to send a hearty fuck the police out to that person. And it's good that they know how everybody feels about them, right? But today, rather than talking about the nuts and bolts of physical confrontations, I'm going to be talking about some slightly, not more abstract, but more strategic stuff, about the ways that social bodies that can resist are constituted, basically, and the ways that we can start to frame our strategies in this context. In doing this, I'm not an expert. I'm here from a much larger circle of comrades who have been having these conversations. And unfortunately, I'm the only one from that circle who can make it here to talk with y'all. And I'm here basically just to try to extend the questions that we've been asking to this larger group and hopefully take back some of y'all's questions with me. What I'm going to do, we've got very little time here, so I'm basically going to try to blast through three different ways of asking this question about how we can strategize in the social context that we're in right now. And then hopefully there'll be a little bit of time for discussion. I'm going to ask if y'all can limit your questions to points of clarification or maybe presenting additional examples during the first part. And then hopefully we'll actually make it so we can have enough time to have a more in-depth discussion of things. Do y'all follow me so far? Is that pretty good? The things that I'm going to be talking about are chiefly relevant to North America, and the examples that I'm drawing on are going to be examples coming from my own experience and the experience of people like myself, you know? But that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't extend further or don't have wider relevance. For example, when I talk about consumer subcultures, punk rock is my first example because, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other consumer subcultures, or that you can't take that example maybe and compare it to things you're familiar with in your own life. So, when we talk about punk rock or about the anti-globalization movement, about these more recent formats for resistance, we can often pin down the critiques that we might have of them, but I less often hear people talking about the historical conditions that gave rise to them. So today I want to talk about the origins of some of the resistance formats that we've been using also, and also critique them so we can think about what might be appropriate for the current moment. Are y'all following me so far? The way I'm speaking is not too abstruse or rushed. Okay. Well, you're going to have to interact with me a little bit, so.
Yeah.
Good.
You're good.
All right. So the first question that I want to ask, the first way I want to frame this question is it in terms of employment, right? Now, in 1994, I was an ex-dishwasher. I'd worked for $4.25 an hour. I worked in a movie theater. You know, I worked all these kind of service industry jobs. You know. We'll get back to why I was probably working in the service industry, but the chief form of resistance that, as an angry, like, 20-year-old occurred to me was to try to resist the alienation of my labor, right? I was like, I read this Freddie Perlman pamphlet where he ends, this state of affairs, capitalism, will continue as long as workers are disposed to alienate their productive capabilities, something like this. And so, you know, my friends and I, being young, untutored, not having any anarchists older than ourselves to advise us, we're just like, well, okay, fuck this shit, we'll just try to not work, you know? And it was crazy, it wasn't necessarily the most effective way to go about fomenting revolution, but we were starting from our conditions, you know? We were starting from the things we knew. And what there was instead of that that we were familiar with, you know, was the idea of this non-alienated activity, non-alienated production, which we had been exposed to through the do-it-yourself subcultures, you know, the punk underground, other things like this, right? So our sort of initial, just sort of instinctive idea was that if we took our energy and dropped out of the system, you know, and sort of adopted this like anti-consumerist attitude, and tried to channel that, you know, our potential into, you know, into some kind of do-it-yourself underground where we were productive outside of the strictures of capitalism, that that we would be able thus to move towards some kind of resistance, right? Okay, so fast forward 16 years, 2010, 2011. In the United States, we have, you know, back then it was like 4% unemployment in the U.S. Now it's like almost 10% that's on the books, and there's another 10% of people who are obviously looking for work, and then on top of that, there's another who knows how many, you know, who have just given up looking for jobs, right? And I think that doesn't include the 2.4 million people behind bars in the U.S. So we're in a totally different context. Some of this is because of you know, the way that production has been moved around the globe, which I'll talk about in a minute. Some of this is because of the ways that that technological development has made a lot of us simply redundant to production. Right? But in any case, unemployment isn't something that makes sense now as something that is going to be in and of itself resistance. You follow me? Apparently, unemployment is a space that, you know, and maybe we should have been able to tell this in 94 by looking back at the 1930s, but, you know, I'm not going to blame the angry service worker that I was then for not getting that, you know? At least I did something, right? But I think it's possible that we may be moving towards an era in which unemployment is more and more essential to the functionings of capitalism in North America. I'm going to get more into what this means in a minute, but in this context, our like anti-consumerist thing, our voluntary dropout thing, it looks sort of like a voluntary austerity program. You know, it's convenient for, you know, the powers that be that we're like, oh, we don't need a whole bunch of goods, we don't need a whole bunch of products. You know, we could just have fulfilling lives without all those things. And they're like, you know, damn right, because there's no way to get you money so you can buy those things anyway. You know? So, like, actually, it might be ideal to have a new generation of dropout bicyclists, you know, who maintain their own volunteer programs to treat the consequences of capitalism. Do y'all follow me? You know, they don't have to, you know, do the food distribution program if we do food at bombs for them, right? You know, and our volunteerism, which was our idea of revolutionary activity, however naive, you know, in 94, volunteer activity, you know, they're thrilled. Please, go to the Gulf, clean the petroleum off the pelicans, you know? Like, do that for free. We'll even have people from BP there, you know, supervising you, right? You know, your free labor will help capitalism run. So I want to talk, as we get through this, about the ways that... it's not just that they're able to deal with having some people unemployed, but actually that free labor is being subsumed into capitalism as a new format, right? You all with me so far? All right. So to try to summarize this question, my first question would be, how do we fight capitalism from outside of the workplace, right? This is something that we were already thinking about 15 years ago, but it's all the more pressing now to figure out how capitalism may be perpetuated outside of the workplace as well, right? So that we can be clear that dropping out and trying to take our productive capabilities into our own hands is not enough. Okay, so I want to frame this question in another way now also, right? In terms of media, in terms of communication, in terms of the like formats in which our potential is given shape inside of the capitalist system. The formats that we're most familiar with from the 20th century are unidirectional, right? You know, looking at communication, you see mass media, television, basically, right? You know, and for me as a teenager, as a person in my early 20s, looking at these unidirectional formats, it was easy to pose the question of how our lives could be better structured, right? You could just say, look at this, we're just like spectators. You know, that was the way we misunderstood society as a spectacle, you know? It's just like we're just spectators watching their spectacle. We're just like watching. What couldn't we just like do something? You know, like well can't we just like interact? Like be participants? You know. And that made a whole lot of sense actually, right? All the stuff through the 20th century. You know, the people that we read growing up were asking questions like this, and it made some sense. You know. So you know, and our answer was instead of network television. You know, zine culture. Instead of us all listening to Bruce Springsteen, we start our own bands. You know, and not just our own bands, but our own cultural milieus. Our own, you know, and punk rock being an example of that. So that was then, right? And that may not even have been how things were then, but that was how it looked to us. So again, fast forwarding to 2010, 2011. How does capitalism work now? It's not unidirectional. Our interactions inside of the market, however many of them we may actually think are liberatory, are participatory. The market itself is participatory, right? And I'll try to give an example of this. Here's something. Go back to 20th century media. You're sitting in a movie theater, something like this, really, right? Sorry, everybody. Where everybody's staring at a screen and there's information that you come in one way. That's actually not the chief format for you know, capitalists cashing in now. I hear that the video game industry is comparable to Hollywood, right? And at this point. And the way that it works, is you have people who are, you know, these multiplayer games where people who never meet each other are interacting. You know, and it's participatory, and they get to do something. You know, you get to control the plot, right? I'm sure, you know, and again, this is the example that is easiest for me to identify, but I'm guessing that if I speak honestly for myself, the way I'm positioned, that I'm speaking for others in other situations too, to some extent. The demand that we made, which was we want to be able to participate, we want to be able to determine our own activity and have our autonomy, that demand has been subsumed. I'll give another example, and there are many. You know, how many people, raise your hand if you know where the technology that Twitter was built upon came from? Okay, in 2004, the Republican National Convention in the United States was going to take place in New York City. And in preparation for this, some friends of mine from Pittsburgh in the Institute for Applied Autonomy put together a computer program, or not a computer program, I'm sorry, it was a program anyway, for text messages to be sent out to multiple cell phones all at once, right? And this is an attempt to innovate in terms of communications technologies so that people could react swiftly to the movements of the police. The name for this technology was TextMob. Now, does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and part of this is just like, we're the exploited, right? That doesn't just mean that we have things forced on us unidirectionally. It actually means that our cultural production, our technological production, our ideas, all of our activities are what drives capitalism. You know, we didn't necessarily know that at the time. Naive young people that I was, you know, and I'm sure there were older people who knew what was going on, but I had no idea, right? So it's kind of outrage to discover how our innovations and our demands, at first might have helped us pose a concrete threat to capitalism, and then become essential to the fabric of it. You know, looking at the internet here as a way to grant our demand for more participatory forms of information and communication, right? I want to say what the internet looks like to me is a new enclosure. You know, you go back in time several centuries, and one of the stages in the laying of the foundations for capitalism was that all of the land that had been held in common was fenced off and privatized, basically. That was an early form of enclosure. The internet, let's say, is the enclosure of our knowledge and our relationships. You know, and one of the dangers in this conversation is that we get into this sort of lifestyleist thing about whether we want to endorse the internet or not. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that it's a question of whether we have our hands free or not. What I am saying is that the internet maybe marks a new frontier in the struggle against the privatization of our lives, you know? A new frontier for struggle. We can avoid that frontier, but that is where some of the struggle is taking place right now. And to be really concrete about what I'm saying, what does this mean, like an enclosure of our relationships? Well, how many of y'all, and I don't want to just say the internet, I'm also talking about cell phones, everything else, how many of y'all can imagine keeping in touch with all the people that you're close with and that you care about without the internet and cell phones? I hate to say this, but I'm guessing that you're older than myself, and you know, and that's probably not a coincidence, right? You know, the folks who are a generation younger than me, I imagine it's harder and harder for them to imagine, you know. That's the new way that our lives are being structured, you know. And on the face of it, the internet, it doesn't actually seem to be a good place for concentrating cash. You know, that may be, on the one hand, that may be because it was developed by the military rather than by corporations, in which case, even the military is better at creating liberatory forms than capitalism is. Now, you know, on the other hand, so that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that that the currencies in which power is going to be concentrated, in which inequalities are going to be imposed, are not just going to be financial in the future. You know, they financial inequalities are not the only kinds that ever existed, right? There are a lot of different currencies for inequalities, and it may be that the kinds of inequality that we see in the future are imposed more by differing access to information, you know, by control of the very formats through which we interact. You know, maybe you don't pay to have a Facebook, but every time you use Facebook, it advertises to you. Your actions are monitored. Y'all are following me, right? Okay. So you know, and one more thing on this subject. In this context, with the way the internet works. Well, okay. One of the things I want to say about the development of capitalism, which is basically a competition to see who can concentrate power in their hands the most effectively. This competition isn't any more gentle with the capitalist class than it is with us, right? New capitalists may stomp out old capitalists. You know, people who are in the middle class may have to be forced into the working class or underclass in order for them to keep accruing more power, you know, in order for power to be concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. And the things that we thought were solutions, you know, may actually make that worse. I'll give an example. In the 1980s, 1990s, when in the U.S., there was a local newspaper in every town, right? And then there were these big newspapers like the, you know, Washington Post, New York Times. Now, all of those newspapers, including the local ones, employed staff writers. That was a job. It was like a middle-class production job, producing information. You know, and all those people are being put out of a job by bloggers now who are willing to work for free, right? And this goes back to what I was talking about employment and unemployment. So much of the distribution of information that we have nowadays takes place in formats where nobody's paying, that you know that it's actually difficult to hold a middle class position in the productive economy. Do y'all follow me here? Another example is that, you know, I got into punk rock and discovered, you know, you could put out a record as a benefit, raise a bunch of money, and use that money to produce anarchist newspapers or whatever, right? You can't put out records as a benefit project nowadays. you know? Everybody expects to get their music for free. Now, and I'm an anarchist, everything should be free, right? But in this current situation, the bands still have to pay for musical equipment, still have to pay for recordings, you know? But if the bands can't actually make money back, then again, we're like volunteers on our austerity program, basically paying out of pocket to fatten a few capitalists. This is part of one of the effects of these enclosures. We're here doing everything freely, feeling more free, but actually getting more and more ripped off. Now, I'm not arguing that we need to defend the middle class and cultural production, of course. I'm arguing for an anarchist revolution destroying productive classes, you know. So to frame my second question, then, before I run out of time here, in a society in which we experience the market not as something that's imposed on us, but as something that we participate in, something that utilizes our initiative and our autonomy, what does it look like to resist? You know, if we can't just say no, we don't want to have this imposed on us. We want to participate. You know, we can't just say that. What can we say? What kind of essential demands can we make that will contest the formats of capitalism? One tentative way to answer that question that I see gaining more popularity again is this sort of insurrectionist thing where instead of participation, the idea is to attack, you know, to interrupt. Now I'm not somebody who thinks that we can just smash shit until everything changes. And thus far there do seem to be challenges to forming new social bodies just around the practice of interruption. But I recognize where that impulse is coming from in the context of a world in which our participation and our desire to participate has been turned against us. Does everybody follow me so far? Okay. So thus far everything I've said is fairly familiar. I'm going to get into the... I'm going to pose my third question here, and I'm going to do so in hopefully not in a more long-winded way than I have. But this is the most experimental, like, of the ideas that we've been talking about. It's the one that's least finished. All right, so I'm going to attempt to run down the history of production, basically, since the 19th century.
You know? Right. Start so soon.
I'm fairly young. All right, so, talking about the Industrial Revolution. Kicked off an era of mass production, right? Mass production initiates a mass society, you know? I was just barely keeping my head up, you know, despite my illness in the Nietzsche discussion yesterday. We were talking about the mass versus the individual. That was a socially produced condition, right? You know? The masses were socially produced as a result of the forms of production that were current. You know, you don't need Marx to say this. Fuck Marx. You know, I mean, he didn't invent that shit. You know what I'm saying? But that's the like. Sorry if I'm alienating anybody. You know, but I mean, that was where mass came from. You know, and it also occasioned mass resistance because, you know, you want to talk about how our social bodies constituted that might be able to resist. Suddenly, we had all these people together who are getting screwed exactly the same way, right? And that's where, you know, the original impetus towards the labor movement, towards labor unions, and also not just unions in the workplace, but the necessity of concentrating workers into a space where they. You know, where they all had to live, where their families would all be together. If you look at the Paris Commune in 1871, that wasn't just workplaces, that was having a whole bunch of poor people concentrated in the city, you know? And so, what do we do, you know, if the capitalists have this question, what do we do to defuse this, you know? What do we do to pacify, you know, these people? So let's shift to the beginning of the 20th century. Henry Ford, right? Henry Ford figures out how to answer that question and another question that was plaguing capitalists. Now, one of the problems capitalists were having, they can mass produce all sorts of shit, you know? But after a certain point, after you've exploited workers to the limits that you can, they don't have any money to buy your stuff, you know? And you're producing the stuff so cheaply because you're mass producing it, but you need new markets to buy it, right? You can't just, So on the one hand, capitalists have a problem. How do we create new markets for our commodities? And on the other hand, they're facing all of this resistance, right? So Henry Ford comes up with a solution for this, where he, first of all, he finds a way to, he looks at the factory the same way that you would look at a machine. He says, all right, let's look at the factory. How do we make the factory more efficient itself so we can speed up our mass production to produce even faster than the other factories do, you know? And this is where automation, the assembly line, comes in. It turns out the first few years he was using this automation process, his workers were quitting so fast that he had to hire 10 people for every one that he needed on the payroll, you know? Because people are just, they're doing this mind-numbing bullshit and can't fucking handle it, you know? As a response, Ford jacks up his salaries. He puts them really high, actually, you know? And everybody else thinks he's crazy, but this works in a couple different ways. First of all, creates a new consumer base, right? And this is the phase where we see not just mass production but mass consumption. Ford also was opposed to unions. He used paying his workers more as a way to. As a way to fend off the possibility of unions in his workplace. But in the post-Ford era, I would say unions actually came into their own within capitalism as a way to broker a compromise. You know, if the unions can force the employers to pay the workers enough that the workers can go on consuming just enough to be part of the market, then that actually puts off the contradictions. You know. Now, when I say this, I'm not saying, so fuck unions. I'm not saying that necessarily. I am saying that unions may be, just like punk rock subcultures, I'm going to argue in a minute, maybe something that's sort of reached its limits as a format for resistance, right? You don't have to agree. I'm trying to be provocative, you know. But I'm also trying to get to the bottom of the historical conditions that they create this, you know. All right. So, So you have two problems in capitalism, you know, at this point. One is the problem with workers getting paid enough to participate in society at all, to survive. And the unions had sort of established a solution there. The other is the problem of alienation, you know. And that problem hadn't been solved, you know. People are doing things that are unfulfilling to them. They're engaged in meaningless activity. And over the next several decades, and getting up to the 1960s, you see that the kinds of resistance that people are engaging in are resistance chiefly to alienation, chiefly to the meaninglessness of their lives. And when I say people, of course, I'm talking more about, you know, folks from my class than I am about folks from even more exploited, you know, sectors of the underclass overseas. Right? I'm talking about North America. Right? In the 1960s, it comes that we see some of the first places that people are resisting are social bodies that are constituted by consumer patterns rather than production patterns. People were brought together in the workplace, you know, and had formed unions. Now people are finding each other through their consumer patterns. What's his name? Jared Rubin in Do It. He says that the 60s generation was the generation that had grown up on Elvis and transitioned together. Elvis and got into more and more crazy stuff. That generation did as well. You see a massive uprising among young people who are, you know, on the terrain of consumption, on the terrain of rejecting. How do capitalists respond to this, you know, to this kind of resistance? They respond to it the way that they always do, by granting the demands within the market. So starting in the 1970s, we see counterculture as a way to propel the market. This lines up with another of the solutions to the capitalist conditions that were know, the candidates were grappling with. Once again, they reached the limits of how much they could profit by mass production, right? So, you know, there's only so many Model Ts you can sell, and then you sold a Model T to everybody who you can get a Model T to. What do they do in this situation? They're like, all right, well, we've sold as many of a given commodities as we can make. We need to diversify the range of commodities. You know? This is a, you know, people talk about post-Fordism, talk about the shift from economies of scale, in which you just produce as much as you can, to economies of scope, in which you produce as wide a range of things as you can. You know? You create as broad a range of identities as you can. The more identities, the more markets. So now we catch up to the cultural formats that I first found my way into anarchism from, which punk rock, you know. So if you look at the 1970s, this is when hip hop and punk both take off. The Crass, the first really influential anarcho-punk band, they also were one of the first bands to successfully produce their own LPs, you know, inside of a new subcultural milieu. Maybe I'm just making up a fairy tale, but hopefully it's a fairy tale that offers some insight into what we can do next. Now, LPs were invested in tremendous meaning because they're, you know, the LPs of the previous generation had been, that was the cultural production of your species, you know, invested with all the meaning that human beings are always going to invest in what other people are doing. But now we have participation, right? Now you can make your own LP and other people will be excited about it. Nobody cares about LPs anymore, you know? I don't know what it's called, like a historical reenactment society? with the like leather and the spiked vests or whatever. A few people care about that. But the LP as a something that has tremendous cultural cachet is basically done. But it's huge, you know? We'll make our own LPs, we'll make them say whatever we want to say, we want to destroy everything. Freedom or whatever it was. this spread anarchist ideas. This was a new phase of anarchist ideas spreading around the world. You know, if you go today to Indonesia, they will tell you that anarchism specifically arrived in Indonesia through anarcho. That's significant, and in some ways it was possible for it to arrive there because it was riding the wave of capitalism and capitalist consumer patterns. But it's also significant in that I actually think that anarchist resistance is a good idea. You know, it doesn't necessarily trump the previous formats for resistance that exist in Indonesia before. You know, but it marks a new era of people trying to internationalize their resistance to capital. Are you all with me so far? I know I'm cramming a whole lot of stuff in here. So I want to talk about globalization and counter-globalization in this new era. So to go back to post-Fordism. What is post-Fordism, right? If Fordism was looking at the factory as if it were a machine and making it more efficient, post-Fordism, starting in the 60s, 70s, means looking at the entire planet and as if it were a machine, right? And trying to figure out how to make it a more efficient machine. And what that the shape that takes is capitalists are like, well, we have this factory here where we have to pay everybody a lot of money, and then there's all these people over here that we've totally ripped off who have nothing. They would work in that factory a lot cheaper. Why don't we just move this factory over there? My grandfather, he worked at Goodyear for 50 years. You know, he got his watch at the end or whatever. You know, and we could just say it's a coincidence that he worked at Goodyear making rubber and that I'm some dropout good for nothing. But, or we could say that those are actually very telling products of a historical development. You know what I'm saying? The context that we have now is that, you know, globalization, they move the factories, they move everything whenever they need to. The world is an assembly line, you know? And in order to produce commodities, you break up the production process into all these different pieces that can take place at any corner of the world and can be moved anywhere else as soon as there's any kind of resistance. Now,
What, how do you resist in this era? You can't just unionize your workplace because, okay, great, oh, y'all unionized, that's good. We're sending your job, you know, we're sending your factory to Mexico and then to Indonesia, you know? That's fine. You can play union at the unemployment office, right? So, why did the anti-globalization movement, as we know it, arise in the 90s? You know, probably as an attempt to internationalize resistance, right? Because what it would take to oppose exploitation on this level would be an international resistance, you know? And there are plenty of limits to like summit hopping as a as a solution, but it was an effort to it was a historically produced effort to figure out what it looks like to have a worldwide unionization, you know, to update that kind of resistance tactic for the new era. And so when we critique those, we've got to critique that format inside of the conditions that gave rise to it. And the G20 protests really are the format they took. To me, it looks sort of like a holdover from the anti-globalization era, you know? But a holdover with no demands, in some ways, at least speaking to the aspects of the G20 protests that resonate best with me. Which may be what we need, you know? All right, so I'm gonna get to my last point, which is that if you follow the story that I've been telling, it seems like first the structures that shaped the social bodies that could resist were determined by production, you know, and then past a certain point, as production passed overseas and, you know, and technological innovations, etc., you have a resistance shaped by patterns of consumption. But now, if we're going to be increasingly unemployed and useless in North America, what are we going to do with ourselves? And that's where this sort of the internet as a playpen for the unemployed comes in. You know, we may not even be able to afford to consume anymore. You know, a lot of the post-economic crisis, not just the jobs, but also the consumption is being shifted overseas. Yeah. All these capitalists are hoping that there will be a Chinese middle class that can buy all of the products that we used to buy. Now, you know, there's controversy as to whether that's going to come to pass or not, but I'm unemployed, I would have a hard time getting a job, and, you know, and that's not controversial. That's the deal, you know? So, you know, if we... This is the context in which I think we should look at other alienating activities besides production and consumption that are being offered to us. You know? There are new currencies that we're being encouraged to compete for now that we're extraneous to the product, you know, to production and consumption. You know, maybe you can't buy a bunch of fancy stuff, you know, except you could buy a university education and a bunch of debt, maybe, you know. Those debts, those obligations are going to determine the character of our lives. But the other thing that we can do is compete for attention, you know? And maybe hits, you know, like in the YouTube sense, are going to be a more determined currency than money for a lot of us, you know? Just because it's the only currency we can still hope to get our hands on. And that makes us all into entrepreneurs, into micro-capitalists, who will never, like, actually have a stake in the system, but who have competition for social currency, for social cachet, as the last thing that we can do, you know, and that they are hoping that we will just do this instead of resistance, you know. And this is a new layer of alienation on top of the market. You know, there's the physical market, the process of production and consumption, and just like on top of that, you have other layers like the stock market, and then the stock market derivatives, which is what helped to bring about the crisis of 2007-2008. There's another layer of alienation on top of that, which is alienation from ourselves, viewing even our social relationships as something in which we can compete, you know, as something in which we try to, we're all trying to accumulate more and more privilege, more and more advantages relative to each other. So my last question, you know, in this context, how do we find each other? How do we constitute new social bodies, you know, that are perhaps extraneous to both production and consumption? You know, and the first example of this that I can think of in the information age right? It's not a coincidence that we keep this track of so much attention in the context of in the interview. Y'all follow me? I've thrown out a million things. Okay, let me see how much time we have. And all right, we're good. So that summarizes my questions and the discussions that have been going on in the circles I'm in. Somebody want to hit me up with a controversial counterstatement? Okay, we have one, and then two, and then three.
You don't come to your conclusion when you talk about younger people being marginalized from the workforce, marginalized from the consumer force. You know, the obvious conclusion is you people are going to be without food. In the system that they're setting up now, they're causing hyperinflation. We're entering a period of austerity, which means that there's going to be no more unemployment insurance, there's going to be no more welfare, there's going to be no more pensions. So we're not talking about how to get more attention or what are the other forms of being marginalized. We're talking about how you people, us people, are going to figure out how to survive in the next few months, next year. That's the question. And we have to talk about not anarchist resistance. Anarchist resistance is just a technique for them to further oppress you. We have to be talking about anarchism as a way of building an alternative society for people who are being marginalized. We live in a continent that's being stripped of its assets, right? As he explained, everything has been offshore. There's no more production going on in this continent. You're no longer going to be having any income in order to feed yourself, let alone provide shelter for yourself. So we have to be talking about, not about resistance, going to G20 protests, figuring out how to protest, figuring out how to protect ourselves from protests. We have to be talking about how we organize ourselves to build our own survival. That's the question. And anarchism is a system of creating that free, libertarian, collective, cooperative process. And that's what we have to be talking about, not about protest and resistance. Protest and resistance is feeding into their plan to oppress us, put us in prisons, put us to work so we can compete with the Chinese. We have to be talking about how to build an anarchist system of our own system of production, our own system of providing services for each other.
Okay, I want to... We don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm going to take another couple questions. If y'all can please keep it succinct, and if you want it to be a question, please frame it as a question. Go ahead.
Okay, very much on the same lines. I understand what you're saying about the free labor, etc. But I'm very inspired by all of these free efforts because it's part of a prefigurative politics, right? It's build the new world in the shell of the old. And just to build on top of him, I mean, you know, Kropotkin, yeah, the conquest of bread, yeah. Meeting people's needs. How do we meet human needs? That's really what we should direct our anarchist efforts. You know, when I see people with healthcare collectives, when I see food not bombs, when I see, rape counseling, whatever, like community collectives, that stuff's awesome. That's the heart of the struggle, and much more than the resistance, etc. Yeah.
I want to say, again, I'm not saying that those things are ineffective. I am saying that we have to constantly be aware of the ways that our responses to their oppression and their destruction can be subsumed into their program. Right. So I'm going to actually take you.
Okay. Well, I just think that one way that it's been framed also is that, like, in the face of everything, like, survival is resistance and is revolutionary unto itself. So I don't know if we necessarily have to view those things as, like, you know, completely mutually exclusive. I think, like, you know, living is, like, a humongous, that's resistance.
So in the back?
Yeah. Just a couple things. One, I think the fuck Marxism chant is a little premature, or at least a little odd, given that so much of your talk drew so much to me from eponymous Marxism. I mean, it seemed like boom, 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 the whole conclusion. Now, I just wanted to say just a few other points there. The question of what's happening with China or jobs moving offshore, I think we're missing a whole element from here, which is the question of the state. And what is the role of the state, and what are the capacities and power of the state in terms of the huge amounts of not only military resources, but also economic resources that can be marshaled by various states. Secondly, we also have the question of the Tea Party, or of right-wing populist movements, which we can't afford to ignore, because they're also mobilizing and moving in this context. And I guess, as a final point, I would also say that on the question of production, there's still a lot of fucking production happening in North America, right? And you can look at there's also structural problems around say peak oil or around ecological questions that means that they can't continue the same kind of global movement of stuff. So we have to look at what is being produced, how it's being produced, and when we do that, we recognize that the number one target of this austerity program is on predominantly public sector unions and the vestiges of the welfare state, which were fought for and won by these older cycles of struggle. So that means we have to relate to those, and if we just sort of back out of that because that's old and not trendy anymore, then I think we also make a serious mistake.
Right. Once again, I'm not arguing for backing out of anything. And about Marx, I'm not saying that Marx wasn't right about a lot of things. I'm saying, I guess, that it's very dangerous to have a cult of personality about any thinkers. And that Marx, you know, the things that Marx was right about, other people have been right about them, you know? And the things that he was wrong about have inflicted grievous suffering upon humanity. So, yes.
I guess I'm more in the Marx category because I think that it's a problem when we frame ourselves and understand ourselves only as producers and consumers, and that's where our politics and action has to come from. And I think that one of the things that, this isn't what you were talking about, but one of the things that I think I like when people talk about is how do we reconceive ourselves in relation to each other as social relationships and build those relationships in things that are not productivist. Like, you don't have to produce things in order to be resistant. In fact, I think I want to not be a producer. I want to resist that compulsion to always be producing something, and rather think about ways in which we can build social relationships that do lead to survivability and sustainability, and that are socially sustainable in the long run, that are not necessarily outside of capitalism, because I don't think we can do that, but that think about who we are and what we want in ways that are not framed in capitalist conceptions of social relationships. This is a rant. I don't really have a solution, but I get really uncomfortable when all we can do is think about ourselves as producers and how can we produce differently. I don't want to be a producer. I don't think that's where my politics are. I want to be a person who's in a community of relationships with other people who have good values and are trying to help each other survive.
All I can do is sprinkle. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to... You in the back?
Yes.
With a smile?
Yeah. Okay. So we want to build alternative communities, right? That's how I live. I live in a communal house. You know, I broke my back in November. The only way I've been living, you know, is through the community, through people helping me with my rent, with my food. We need to build these alternative spaces, free schools, food not bombs, all of these things. These are not opposed to political struggle, and they need to be spaces for political struggle. You know, we can't just build these alternative spaces and be like, okay, look, we're meeting our needs, the state will leave us alone. That never happens. Indigenous peoples, like hippie communes, you know, you can make your own alternative spaces and the state will come and crush you. You know, when we build these alternative spaces to help each other, these have to be spaces for political action to overthrow this fucking system.
Looks like we're almost out of time, so I'm going to take the person over here that's been waiting for a little bit. You've been there. I'm going to take you, and then you. Go ahead.
All right. Let me say that I was absolutely surprised by how much I agreed with you. Coming from an anarchist communist and libertarian Marxist background. My one issue I would raise, has been sort of raised here, is you say, well, that's, I get the impression that you're leaving out writing off struggle in the workplace.
I tried to make it clear I wasn't.
Okay.
But go on, please.
Given that, while it's true that the level of unemployment is very high, and we have to deal with that, even back in the 30s, the Great Depression, there were unemployment leagues, for example. And we're going to, I believe we're going to see something like that again. But even if you have 10% unemployment or 20% unemployment, that means you got 90% employed or 80% employed, which means that there's an enormous issue of possibility of struggle inside the workplace. And without even getting to the question of how you relate to the unions and all that stuff. Plus the fact that when you talk about international struggle, you mentioned, you know, the anti-globalization and so forth, all of which was good. But it's also have to deal with the fact that one reason we've been sort of deindustrialized is because industry has gone abroad. There is, right now, capitalism has created a worldwide working class to extent that's never existed before. I think a large part of our internationalism should be working class internationalism. It doesn't mean writing off anybody else, but it's a very important part of our perspective should be how to build the worldwide revolution to finally solve this.
We got time for one more question that I want to make my closing comments.
I guess I was just going to suggest
louder.
I guess I am kind of like understanding your concern of the idea of kind of information becoming a new currency, etc., and also these kind of older ways of resisting, like things that are meant to not bombs, all these kind of things playing potentially into a system like austerity measures, like you say. But I also think that these kind of community alternatives can be used to work against this kind of concentration of information, particularly kind of expertise, because I think that reclaiming things like what someone mentioned, like medical collections, medical knowledge, these kind of things that are being increasingly specialized and concentrated in unions and thereby used to kind of control people. Reclaiming those kind of knowledge specifically, and even things, I don't know, things like hacking, whatever, can be used not only kind of as the kind of survival strategies with things like food, but also to combat this kind of concentration of information, I guess.
I agree. I mean, again, I guess I haven't really disagreed with anything anybody said except when they were writing off some other format for struggle. Maybe I'm too big tent, you know. But if I was gonna send a particular message, I would say, whatever you're doing, first of all, don't think it's the only way to do things. Right? It's probably determined by where you're situated. And second of all, whatever you're doing, make sure that you are doing, you know, everything you can to confront and subvert the forces of hierarchy, right? That's, you know, because there's no way out of that. You may actually find yourself playing an essential role, even as an unemployed dropout, you know, or as a workplace organizer, if you're not intentional about confronting all of the different roles that capitalism perpetuates, right? So we've run out of time. I brought up a whole lot of stuff. Please come talk to me about it. And
put this right here so you don't lose your